Independence Day, after all the fireworks, is a celebration of the most basic freedoms we enjoy, as determined and outlined in the early days of nationhood. But since that blazing summer of 1865, those very rights have been tested, revoked, fought for, and won time and time again by social reformers, whether they were political figures, journalists, or ordinary citizens.
One example of this ongoing fight to defend our rights involved the controversial comedy of George Carlin and our own Pacifica Radio. In 1978, Carlin's use of what he dubbed filthy words resulted in litigation whose ruling would impact media for decades to come.
On July 3, 1978, the United States Supreme Court ruled 5-4 against the Pacifica Foundation in the case, after a session in which justices debated the very core of our right to self-expression.
What made a renegade station on the still new FM band broadcast those words onto the streets of New York City? A shift in the relationship between the audience and the media created a new demand for a type of programming more irreverent, earnest, and immediate than what had been possible before.
This hour, we'll explore the details of the so-called Carlin case, the evolution of the meaning of free speech, and the generation that pushed its rights beyond the scope of what was conceivable back in Independence Hall. You're listening to a Pacifica Radio special for U.S. Independence Day. I'm Kim King.
I'm Tony Diaz. After the break, we'll consider the history of the progressive freeform FM radio broadcast tradition in which George Carlin's fateful monologue was aired. Stay tuned.
Welcome back. This is an Independence Day special produced by Pacifica Radio. I'm Kim King.
And I'm Tony Diaz. We're looking back at the 1978 Supreme Court case, Federal Communications Commission versus the Pacifica Foundation, a landmark ruling on free expression, also known as the Carlin case.
Mass media in the United States, especially television and radio, was experiencing a great shift in its relationship to the public.
The discussion today will focus on the question of the war in Vietnam. I think it's terribly important that the American people hear from experienced military officers and understand that there is not a unanimity of view on the war which is currently taking progress in Southeast Asia.
For the first time, voices and images of the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War were piped into American living rooms night after night.
Historians have long grasped the importance of media in social movements, but the prominent role played by radio and television during this period was, by all accounts, a watershed moment. The exposure to images of war inspired Americans to begin grassroots campaigns, from the anti-Vietnam movement to the long battle for African-American human rights in the United States.
There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief.
In 1933, inventor Edwin H. Armstrong patented FM radio, a frequency modulation of the radio wave that brought a sound quality heretofore unheard on the airwaves. Yet it was not until over two decades later that FM truly began to take hold.
American radio, particularly the new FM band, reflected the new taste of the times, airing counterculture rock music, socially conscious folk, rhythm and blues, and content that pushed the very boundaries, the small number of FM broadcasters would profoundly affect the youth of the time.
FM was outlaw radio in the late 1960s and early 1970s. While AM focused on pop and teen idols of the era, FM boasted a unique blend of psychedelic rock, soul, and other sounds. The style became known as freeform radio. With no playlist or format, the style came to be characterized by its chaotic charm. FM radio stations around the United States celebrated this status, and freeform radio became ever more widespread.
The sound could be brash, and it appealed to a generation of young people whose favorite artists would never be heard on AM radio.
FM, by virtue of its superior technology, became the medium that we young people grew up with more of an interest in because we could hear albums in stereo.
Dwayne Bradley is a longtime community radio activist and the general manager of KPFT in Houston, Pacifica's Texas outpost. The rise of FM and freeform radio came right in time for him and helped inspire a range of musical interest and a sense of fearlessness in challenging what his generation was coming to regard as antiquated traditions and laws.
Now, of course, this also was the era of the 8-track tape, pre-cassette, pre-CD, pre-personal computer. And so it was a completely different era. And this was long before the media consolidations. Most radio stations and television stations were still owned by local families in the towns they operated. They weren't playlisted. They weren't pre-programmed. They weren't sent down from some corporate office in Nashville or New York or L.A. But FM, in a short number of years, seemed to take over the airwaves and became the dominant mode of listening to music, of cultural expression, of voices of dissent were heard. And you have to also remember this was during the height and then the wind down of the Vietnam War. So FM radio was the medium that youth gravitated toward because they could hear high quality sound, they could hear albums, and it was a much more free, expressive time for both the folks who were doing the programs on the air and those of us who were enjoying listening to it out in the community.
Dwayne Bradley speaking on the evolution of FM radio in the context of social movements and the Vietnam War.
FM sound often broke taboos. Paul Gorman, the WBAI programmer on whose program the George Carlin monologue aired, explains non-commercial broadcasts, especially Pacifica's, were programmed this period with a few basic precepts, including the right of communities, rather than the FCC, to control the airwaves.
I don't think the FCC should have any power over what words are used over the radio. But I should also say that I respect the fact that there are people in the audience and in the community who find certain words offensive and would not want their children to hear those words. For an example, if one of you listening right now to me were walking down the street with your 6-year-old son or daughter, and you passed a group of teenagers for whom dirty words was a kind of a way of asserting your masculinity if they were all boys, and you didn't want your daughter or young son to hear those words, the first thing you would do would take them by the hand and cross the street and take them out of earshot. I respect the rights of people to see dirty words as a moral question and an aesthetic question and an issue of upbringing. You know, I wouldn't for a minute deny their right, or I wouldn't for a minute disrespect that. And that's why I issued that disclaimer. But I think those people who were concerned with that have to ask themselves the question, who should determine whether those words are going to be used? Should there be a body of people appointed by the President of the United States, subject to all sorts of political pressures, who sit in judgment of words trying to determine whether one word, which means the same thing as another word, can be said? Why is it possible to say one rather than the other? So the power, in my view, should not rest with the FCC. The power should rest with the community. The community has the right to, among other things, withdraw commercial support from the station that uses words that the community itself finds objectionable. The community has the freedom to take its own actions and make its own complaints. But as for the FCC, they should not tell the people what they should say, nor should they tell them what they should hear. The people should have the right to define their own culture, and that we are increasingly in a situation where culture is being imposed on the people, whether it be role models and stereotypes, whether it be attitudes towards authoritarianism and violence, images of gender, and so forth. Increasingly, we're in a situation where the people are not defining their own culture. And that is what I would call a form, really, of cultural imperialism by profit-making institutions called the commercial media. And that a deep political issue is at stake in all of this, as to whether or not the people, through their own instruments, in this case a listener-sponsored non-commercial radio station, are going to have the opportunity to define their own culture. Language, words, being one of the principal instruments of culture.
Gorman's sentiments were common during the period, and on the opposite coast of WBAI, University of California at Berkeley students spoke out about control too. Mario Savio was among the most visible leaders of the free speech movement, and the eventual victory of this movement would hasten the emergence of the new left.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Savio and the free speech movement captured media attention by creating contextual links in their efforts for free speech. Gorman says the original intent of the Carling airing was to discuss the moral consequence of words in the service of free speech.
It happened, as I remember, to be discussing the way in which political dialogue at that time, and certainly in years before that, in the 60s and early 70s, that political dialogue was doing great damage to words, in my view, and that the power of words and that the importance of being careful about words and that the integrity of words was being lost. And I remember raising, for example, the fact that if you looked on either side of the great political struggle of that age, if you looked to the government, you heard, for example, the Central Intelligence Agency, interesting words in themselves, use the words extermination with extreme prejudice to describe killing somebody, or talked about national security, that the bombs that were being dropped on Vietnam at that time were being dropped by an agency of government which described itself as the Defense Department, etc., etc., etc. There were many other examples of protective reaction strike. Was what bombing people's heads and killing them was described as. One could find the same thing among those people who were opposing those very actions by the government. The most immediate example that springs to mind at that time was the phrase, off the pig, which seemed to me not to be so different in its moral effect than extermination with extreme prejudice. Not being able to say kill, not being able to say person, but off the pigs, and loose uses of the word revolution, etc., etc. So the discussion was about the power of words and the moral consequence of words and the fear we have of words and the way words arise from the culture and the way the culture redefines itself through its use of words. That was roughly the topic of the program as it was being conducted by myself and by listeners who were calling in live spontaneously. That was also being supplemented, I should say, by various readings of authors who had talked about words principally some excerpts of essays by George Orwell. Inevitably, the topic came to what we call dirty words. And the discussion turned on the issue, is there such a thing as a dirty word? Or are there just dirty actions or dirty deeds? And so we moved inevitably into the area of indecency and obscenity. And one caller, I think I remember calling up and say, why is it that the word or a word that's used to describe the act of love is also used as an insult? So we discussed what the FCC now is trying to describe as indecent words. At that moment, there was just perfect appropriateness of a monologue by George Carlin entitled Seven Dirty Words You Can't Say on Television, I think was the title. And artistically, it was the moment where that had to be played for the overall effect of the program. And it also raised, in a different way than I had been raising them, in a dramatic way, and even in a provocative way, which I understood, and even introduced what we call a disclaimer, which is letting people know that they might hear some words they would find offensive, but nevertheless was raising that issue in a different way than had been raised in the course of the program, in a dramatic way, by the repetition of those words, by making people listen and laugh and feel whatever hypocrisy and double standards and confusion lies between the use of words and the actions they describe.
That was Paul Gorman, and I'm Kim King. You're listening to an Independence Day special on the Supreme Court's FCC versus Pacifica ruling, also known as the Carlin case, an incident that would shape media for generations to come.
And I'm Tony Diaz. After the short break, the Carlin case, the recording in question, and matters of free expression. Please stay tuned.
Welcome back. This is an Independence Day special on the Supreme Court's FCC versus Pacifica ruling, also known as the Carlin case, a judgment that was handed down July 3, 1978. I'm Kim King.
And I'm Tony Diaz. Before October 30th, 1973, listeners of WBAI's Paul Gorman show had never heard all seven words regulated by the Federal Communications Commission. Satirist George Carlin changed this in a 12-minute monologue called Filthy Words.
Then I was thinking about the curse words and the swear words, the cuss words, and the words you can't say, you're not supposed to say all the time. Because words, people are into words, they want to hear your words. Some guys like to record your words and sell them back to you if you can. Listen in on your telephone, write down what words you say. A guy used to be in Washington, knew that his phone was tapped, used to answer, Hoover, yes, go ahead. Okay. And I was thinking one night about the words you couldn't say on the public airwaves, the ones you definitely couldn't say, ever. Because I heard a lady say, bitch, one night on television, and it was cool, like she was talking about, you know, and they, well, the bitch is the first one to notice that in the litter, Johnny, right? All right. And bastard you can say, and hell and damn. So I had to figure out which ones you couldn't, and ever, and it came down to seven, but the list is open to amendment, and in fact has been changed by now. A lot of people pointed things out to me, and I noticed some myself. The original seven words were, those are the ones that'll curve your spine, grow hair on your hands, and
Maybe even bring us, God help us, peace without honor. What a burden.
The station warned listeners that the monologue included, quote, sensitive language that might be regarded as offensive to some, unquote. Carlin's monologue appeared on his 1973 release, Occupation Fool. The recording is aired around 2 o'clock in the afternoon on WBAI.
At around that time, John H. Douglas, a planning board member of Morality and Media, was driving with his 12-year-old son and says he heard the broadcast. Carlin's utterance were raised by Douglas in a complaint filed with the FCC. In this reading of Douglas's letter, dated November 28, 1973, there are moments of silence. That's because stations aren't allowed to air those words. In his letter, Douglas demanded a response.
On October the 30th, in the early afternoon, from approximately 1:30 p.m. to 2:30 p.m., while driving in my car, I tuned to radio station WBAI in New York City. I heard, among other obscenities, the following words, and a whole list of others. This was supposed to be part of a comedy monologue, whereas I can perhaps understand X-rated phonograph records being sold for private use. I certainly cannot understand the broadcast of same over the air that supposedly you control. Any child could have been turning the dial and tuned into that garbage. Sometime back I read that topless radio stations were fined for suggestive phrases. If you fine for such suggestions, should not this station lose its license entirely for such blatant disregard of the public's ownership of these airwaves? Can you say that this is a responsible radio station that demonstrates a responsibility to the public for its license? I'd like to know, gentlemen, just what you're going to do about this outrage. And by copy, I'm asking our elected officials the same thing. And incidentally, my young son was with me when I heard the above, and unfortunately, he can corroborate what was heard. Yours truly, John H. Douglas, New York City.
In early 1975, the Federal Communications Commission issued a declaratory judgment. The commission stated it wanted to clarify broadcast standards in light of increasing numbers of complaints about indecency on radio. The FCC said this type of speech was different from other forms of expression. The Pacifica Foundation took the case to court and won, but the FCC appealed all the way to the Supreme Court.
The National Association of Broadcasters, CBS, ABC, NBC, the Motion Picture Association of America, and the American Civil Liberties Union all filed amicus briefs in support of Pacifica. At the time, no one knew that this would be the framework for one of the most important Supreme Court cases on free speech in almost 30 years.
We'll hear arguments next in Federal Communications Commission against the Pacifica Foundation. Mr. Marino?
On April 18, 1978, the Federal Communications Commission and Pacifica argued the case before the High Court. The central question to come before the Supreme Court, does the First Amendment prohibit the government the power to restrict the public broadcast of indecent language under any circumstances?
Mr. Marino, you may proceed.
Louis F. Claiborne and Joseph A. Marino argued the case in favor of the sanctions. They and the justices wrangled with a number of issues, including the definitions of indecency, as well as criminality and liability.
If we're looking at this as a criminal statute and not...
It is a criminal statute, isn't it? There is no statute except a criminal statute.
We think that it would violate the commission's construction of the statute, yes.
Well, now, let me ask you again. Would it constitute a crime in the opinion of the Federal Communications Commission? Or do you have a position on that?
I don't think we have a position on that, Your Honor. And I think
take the view that the statute can, the same words in the same statute can mean different things in different proceedings?
If it's for purposes of regulatory action in one case and channeling the words into a different time period, and in another case, really, the reason why I hesitate on the crime is because that's really a question that we would defer to the Justice Department. If we brought a complaint to them and they said this doesn't constitute an offense, that would be the end of it.
Do you have any direct criminal enforcement authority?
No.
Can you bring a criminal?
No, we can't. We have to refer to the.
To the question about CB, are the CB people licensed in some way? Do they get a license of some sort?
They do, Your Honor.
would not the commission at least have arguably some other remedy against the holder of a license by canceling his license?
Yes, Your Honor. We have administrative or regulatory actions.
Just as you do with a broadcast license at the end of his, when he came up for renewal, this kind of conduct would certainly be a factor to be considered in the renewal of the license, would it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, Mr. Maria, doesn't the commission consider any number of factors at the time of license renewal that very likely the government couldn't prosecute a station for criminally?
Yes, Your Honor, under the public interest standard, it would have to be in one violation might not rise to the level of justifying some action at renewal, but yes, it would.
Well, why doesn't the commission justify this particular rule under the public interest standard as a definition of the public interest standard?
Your Honor, the commission has been given at least, there are at least three sections in the Communications Act. They're all in which Congress has asked the commission to enforce 1464 by administrative actions. And it feels that in a situation where we are reaching a type, at least words, that since there was the prohibition, the indecency prohibition, that was the way to reach it, to try to give it some concrete meaning. In response to Justice Stevens' question, we do refer cases to the Justice Department for prosecution of CB operators, and I think that's really the only area that I know of in which there have been any recent convictions for violating 1464. I think there were two cases arising in the Seventh Circuit, and in which I know you were on those panels where those prosecutions were appealed.
Well, we were interested in Mr. Claiborne's response to Justice Stevens' question.
But I'm still not completely clear on whether the commission takes a position that the same statutory meaning can have a different. Same statutory words can have a different meaning in a civil proceeding for cancellation or whatever it might be, and also than it has in a criminal proceeding. In other words, can the word indecent have a broader meaning in one proceeding than it has in another when it's in the same statute?
As Justice Stevens has pointed out, we have not only the indecency prohibition.
Well, I understand you have the public interest theory, but to the extent that you rely on the criminal statute, do you say that word has different meaning depending on the kind of proceeding that is brought to enforce that statute?
I guess we rely on more than the criminal statute. We rely on the criminal...
But to the extent that you rely on that statute, do you contend that the same word has two different meanings depending on the nature of the proceeding that's brought?
I don't think we could, because Congress wrote the word, and all we're trying to do, Your Honor, is give some limiting construction to
but
it.
But you're not confined to that statute on a renewal of a license, are you, by any means?
We are not, Your Honor. We have the public interest standard. You're absolutely correct. The commission feels...
The same conduct, the same words, whether they were ultimately found to be criminal or non-criminal, might constitute a basis for not renewing a license, might they not?
The public interest standard would have to be... The commission would have to make as you pointed out in United Church of Christ, the commission has to make a positive finding that renewal of this application is in the
public interest.
Pacifica was represented by Harry M. Plotkin, a former assistant general counsel to the Federal Communications Commission.
Mr. Plotkin.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I would like to place this case just a little bit into proper perspective so that we'll know what we're talking about, because we are talking about a criminal statute.
Pacifica's defense addressed the merit of artistic expression and what is permitted on the air.
There was an announcement that some of the words on this program may be of a delicate and offensive nature, and those who might be offended by it might tune out for 15 minutes and come back at the end of the program.
You think that leads young people to turn off the program? Or is that intended?
No, it might be an invitation.
Or is that intended to be a come-on to be sure that they'll listen?
It's awfully hard to know, both in advertising and in general. You know, this type might be invitational rather than the contrary. I think on this type of station it is not, because this is not a type of station that's devoted to commercial enterprises. This was not a pandering program. It's not a titillating program. It's a station that does devote itself to the unusual programming, to the highly controversial program, to a wide variety of programming. And while on other stations this type of ad might be a come-on, On this type of station, I don't think this is the intention, but I don't think we're dealing with subjective matters. I think we're dealing with objective
and
facts.
And, of course, the child at the two then knows what kind of station.
Oh, yes. Yes, the child was sitting with his father and presumably...
No, I say the average child knows that this is an educational station which has a broad range of programs all of us. How in the world could a child know that?
How could he know that it's educational?
Yeah.
Well, this particular child, we know very little about him. We only know about his father who sent in a complaint. But in any event, he sends in a complaint, and Pacifica Foundation answered that this was the work of a social satirist, and that this was intended to have a discussion of the whole subject. The FCC then adopted a memorandum opinion and order. They adopted a memorandum opinion and order as part of an overall proceeding where the commission, in response to complaints from Congress and pressure from other groups, was addressing several different subjects: violence, sex-related programs, and obscene and indecent language. And very interestingly, they talked at great length about violent programs, and they're talking about television as well as radio. They're talking about violent programs, they're talking about sexually oriented programs. And very interestingly, the commission says that while there may be social harm even attributable to some of these things, there's nothing we can do about it because this is a very delicate area of the First Amendment, and therefore this is the sort of thing we leave to the station's good judgment, to their editorial discretion and judgment. But when it comes to obscenity or indecency, it says it's a different subject, because here we have a statute, a specific criminal statute, 18 U.S.C. 1464. And this statute says you can do something about obscenity, indecency, or profanity that you can't do with respect to violence or sex-oriented material. And it's important to look at the statute. The statute is not part of the Communications Act, but it does forbid the utterance of indecent, obscene, or profane language over radio, whether it's radio, television, CB, any other type of radio communication. And the commission is given specific authority to enforce it either by revoking the license, by issuing a cease and desist order, or by levying a fine. Here they didn't do any of those three things. Here they issued a general declaration which says that we find that these type of words, particularly when children are likely to be in the audience, are indecent because they refer in a patently offensive manner to sexual or excretory activities or organs, and that therefore they should be banned during that period, and that they cannot be redeemed by context. Even though they have literary, artistic, or scientific value, they are banned per se. They do go on to say...
Are you arguing now that this has literary or artistic value?
As a matter of fact, in the overall context, yes, it was, yes. The words themselves may not, but in the overall context, yes, Your Honor.
Plotkin argued that the FCC already had a role in regulation and that freedom of speech warranted constitutional consideration.
Here we have a statute that uses indecent, obscene, indecent, or profane. Exactly the same type of words that are used in 18 U.S.C. 1461, which has been before this court in the Hamlin case. And this court has specifically held that it's a matter of statutory construction that when those words are used, the word indecent, filthy, vile, and obscene must mean the same as obscene in order to satisfy the dual test of avoiding vagueness under the Due Process Clause, and must, as a whole, appeal to prurient interests, and must be without any literary, artistic, social, or scientific value.
To say held may be a little bit of an overstatement, may it not?
Well,
we did not confront the entire section by section of the statute in that opinion.
I have the same problem as my predecessor here, since you wrote the opinion, Your Honor. But you say,
maybe
and we now problem. So.
Yeah,
and say we now so construe it as to avoid the problem. I think that's as strong as language to a third person as is possible to say. I'm not saying that, that no other conclusion was possible, but the language is very strong that in order to save the statute, it was so construed.
Well, there's no doubt that the words are there in the opinion. I think my equivalent, it may be equivalent, is for you to describe it as a holding. Since a holding is presumably the application of the law to the particular set of facts before the court.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. And technically, that was 1461 there, and this is 1464. But the words in the statute are the same. The medium is the same. We have a First Amendment medium here, just as we do there. And it seems to me that not only do we have a First Amendment medium under the First Amendment, but Section 326 of the Communications Act specifically says that the commission shall have no power of censorship.
This argument wasn't without controversy. Justices sparred with Plotkin over an array of interpretations, particularly cultural reactions to profanity on the radio.
If it is constitutional for a statute to say that obscene material cannot be printed in the newspaper.
I'm getting away from the Constitution. I'm speaking just on the statute.
Yes, well, I don't think
326... You've taken the position just now that 326 was the anti-censorship statute, meant what it said.
Yes.
And what posture, then, is left to 1464?
I think 326 has to be read in the same light as the First Amendment when it says no censorship. It says no censorship of the material is constitutionally protected. I do not think that the commission by 326 has less power than the government does, say, against a newspaper. If they have obscene material, if you can prevent obscene material under 1461.
In a silent courtroom, the justices delivered their decision, with Justice John Paul Stevens representing the majority.
There are four questions that the court decides. The first is whether the case involves a review of a general rule or merely a determination that the particular broadcast as given in the afternoon to an audience which included large numbers of children as well as an adult audience could be regulated as indecent. And the court first holds that the focus is on the particular broadcast rather than a general rule. Secondly, the court considers whether the section of the Communications Act which prohibits censorship prohibited the commission from reviewing the matter, and the court holds that that prohibition, which was enacted as part of the same statute that prohibits the use of indecent, profane, or obscene language, is not applicable to the subsequent review of program content such as this, and there's no dissent within the court on that proposition. The third question the court considers is whether the broadcast is indecent within the meaning of the statute when it does not appeal to the prurient interest and therefore is not obscene. And on this issue, the court holds by a majority of 5-4 that the broadcast was indecent within the meaning of the statute. Justice Stewart has written a dissent in which Justice Brennan, Justice Marshall, and Justice White have joined, taking the position that the statute does not prohibit the broadcast. Then the fourth issue is whether the First Amendment to the United States Constitution precludes the commission from exercising any sort of censorship or regulatory power over an indecent broadcast of this kind. On this issue, the court is also divided. Five members of the court hold that the First Amendment does not prohibit the exercise of this kind of power and therefore sustains the action of the commission in asserting its regulatory jurisdiction over this kind of broadcast.
In its finding, the court said audience, medium, time of day, and method of transmission are all to be considered factors in determining penalties.
In addition, the court determined limited civil sanctions could be levied against a radio broadcast of patently offensive words dealing with topics such as sex. The words themselves, the justices determined, need not be obscene to warrant sanctions.
You are listening to an Independence Day special on the Supreme Court's FCC versus Pacifico ruling, also known as the Carlin case. I'm Tony Diaz.
And I'm Kim King. After this short break, comedian George Carlin on the case with which he's notoriously associated. Please stay tuned.